Welcome to Work From Your Happy Place, the podcast that equips you with the tools, know-how, and motivation to live your dreams and find your happy place. Be sure to sign up for our free weekly newsletter for a recap of the week's guests and a preview of what's in store. To sign up, simply text the word happy place with no space to 33444. Now, it's my pleasure to introduce the host of Work From Your Happy Place, Belinda Ellsworth.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Work From Your Happy Place. I'm your host, Belinda Ellsworth, and I have a lovely guest in store for you today, Manisha Thakur. She serves as the Vice President of Financial Well-Being at Brighton Jones, one of the nation's most innovative and rapidly growing wealth management firms. With the firm's support, she launched the True Wealth podcast in March of 2019 to help people shed the flawed equation that wealth equals happiness by giving them tools from a wide range of experts on how to redefine success and craft one's own definition of true wealth. Manisha is a Harvard MBA, CFA, CFP, as well as an author, speaker, teacher with an extensive national media experience. It is my pleasure to welcome Manisha to our show today.
Belinda, it's great to be here with you.
Oh, wonderful. So Manisha, just fill in some of the gaps. You know, bios are always a little bit stuffy. So why don't you just tell us a little bit about yourself and more importantly about your journey? People always want to know, how did you get where you are today?
Yeah, so I'm always fascinated by people's journeys too. And what I love about them is they're never linear and mine isn't either. So I've long been fascinated by the intersection of women's rights and personal finance. And I come from a very rare background in that my dad, who is a CPA, taught me about money at a very young age. And my mom read me feminist children's books. I can remember I was about 11 years old and my dad sat me down and showed me how to calculate if I saved my babysitting and lawn mowing money and I invested it. By the time I was 65, how much I would have. And, you know, when I saw those numbers, I'm like, wow, I want to know about finance. And my mom, because she read me all these gender neutral books, made me really feel like I could be anything that I wanted to be. And so that's where it really started for me, was at that age. And as I spent my whole career in finance, I just turned 49. And what I found over the time is those early lessons have so dramatically changed my life path. They've given me voices and choices, and I'm really passionate about sharing them with as many people as I can so that they can have the same kind of opportunities. And, you know, the last thing I'll just say about my journey, I had spent my junior year abroad at Oxford University when I was in college. And as I was flying back on the plane, I was reflecting on what I'd learned, and I drew this triangle on a cocktail napkin, and I wrote at the top simplicity, and I wrote in the bottom left-hand corner small joys, and I wrote in the right-hand corner financial independence. And I thought, though, that's my guiding mantra for life. And every year at the new year, I look at it again and see if I want to add anything. And, you know, over the past 2+ decades, the only thing I've added is in the middle of the triangle, I put the word curiosity. So that's how I ended up where I am. I'm on more of a human, not a LinkedIn profile basis.
Oh, that's great. A question for you, and this might throw you, because I know we didn't talk about this, but I'm just really curious as you're telling your story. I think I was taught at a pretty young age about saving, and, you know, I worked little odd jobs like that, you know, babysitting. I had a paper route, just some different little odd jobs. And how do you feel? So then I think that sort of there was this next generation of just not a lot of knowledge about what money could do for you. But then today's generation seems to be a little bit more in tune, or is that just my thought process? Or how do you feel that young kids today are really viewing money, or is it talked about? How do you see that has morphed over the years?
So I definitely feel this next generation is talking about it more. Mm-hmm. I sit on the board of the National Endowment for Financial Education, which is the nation's preeminent nonprofit focused on financial education for ages 13 to 35. And so I think about this stuff a lot. And I think the biggest reason we're seeing it for this generation versus ours is we didn't graduate with a mortgage from college. This generation is graduating with student loans that are so large that the things we have the flexibility to do coming out of college, this generation just doesn't. And so they have to be extra careful with their money and think about it. Also, this generation saw their parents weather the 2007-2009 financial crisis, which is the worst one we've had since the Great Depression. And I think the combination of having high student loan debt and seeing financial fragility, job fragility firsthand while they were likely high school, college, mm-hmm. really, really has made a big difference.
Well, that's good. That's a good thing, I think.
It is. And, you know, the thing I worry about most is, particularly for women, is that we are great savers, but we tend not to invest. And because mm-hmm. we're going to live so long, it doesn't matter how much we save. If we don't invest it, it's not going to keep up with inflation. And so that to me is the really big nut that I'm hoping the word continues to get out about.
That is such a, oh my gosh, great point. And you're right. I mean, I look at even myself and, you know, I have some investments and I follow the advice of an investment firm, but I don't really put tons extra, but I'm always like saving and I'm always looking at my savings, different saving buckets and like, okay, am I good there? Do I have this? Am I covered there? And it's like, I think more about it than I do the investments. I just yeah. have to be super honest.
Yeah.
And I think I'm smarter than about money than a lot of my friends that are women. I think they rely, you know, so much more on their spouses or really kind of don't know a lot about where their financial situation stands.
Well, and the scary thing about that, Belinda, is when you look at the knowledge levels about finance between men and women, they actually are not very different. The difference is men have a much higher confidence level around that same knowledge. You know, if you know, it's a scale of 1 to 10, men may have a knowledge level of 6 and women a 5, but men's confidence levels are at an 11 and women's confidence levels collectively are at maybe a 3. And so when you let your spouse take over, it's not necessarily, I mean, with the best intentions, they may think they know what they're doing, but the studies and the results show, you know, over half of Americans don't have access to $2,000 in an emergency. Like, they could not come up with $2,000 by any means in 30 days if they had an emergency.
Wow.
And, you know, less than 20% of Americans have gone through the exercise of calculating what they should be aiming for in terms of retirement savings and therefore backing into how much they need to save a year to get there. So mm-hmm. handing it over to your spouse may feel comforting, but it's not a guarantee that they know.
Right.
And I'll tell you one funny story on that. I'm divorced now, but I was married to a man who was 20 years older than me. And we would go out socially, and I'm short and he's tall. I'm 5'4" and he was 6'4". And there's something about tall men. People seem to just think they're smart. And my ex-husband is smart. But we would go out, and because of the age difference, and most of them didn't know I went to Harvard Business School or I worked in finance. And the women would congregate and the men would congregate. And I'd always gravitate towards the men in the business conversations. And I'd be like a fly on the wall. And I think they'd look at me like, what is she doing in our group? And, you know, Belinda, it was so funny because it's no one would call each other out on it. And it was like the emperor's new clothes. And so the point I want to make is even highly educated individuals generally don't get a formal education in personal finance, and certainly not a formal education generally in investing. Mm-hmm. And so if you feel embarrassed or you're not sure what's going on, you are not alone. So I like to just make sure people, because there's a lot of money shame I've noticed.
Well, and I do think that exists. There is a lot of money shame, but all the way around, like a whole 360 of it. It's even in making the money. I think women have really, I've never had issues with making money. In fact, I find it fun. Like, I find the thrill of making money and coming up with ways to do that. You know, like, that's always been exciting for me. And I've never felt like, oh, there was something wrong with that. But I can't tell you, in teaching women in sales, and then they start doing well, and then they start making really good money. Not only are they not clear with what to do with it, but they feel like they don't deserve it. They feel like they shouldn't be making that much money, or there's something wrong with making that much money. That it's this the weirdest thing. And so then they actually start to sabotage their own success and not do as well as they were doing because they have this guilt around making this much money. And I see that a lot.
Yeah, I see that exact same thing too. And I've been thinking a lot about it, like what is going on? And there's a wonderful TED Talk by Reshma Saujani that's got like millions and millions of views, but it's and she recently wrote a book off of it called Brave Not Perfect. And she's just highlighting the different ways that we socialize boys and girls. And, you know, from a young age, for example, if boys fall down, we tell them, oh, brush it off. And if girls fall down, we encourage them to either not take more risk or to be more perfect. And I think it also, I mean, that's one message that we get. But I think from a younger age, boys are socialized to think about themselves as breadwinners and girls not as often. And so this weird dynamic can come into play. And I'm seeing it even more and more because more women are becoming co and primary breadwinners. And that's just throwing off the whole male-female dynamic. And mm-hmm. Farnoosh Torabi wrote a wonderful book about this called When She Earns More. And so I think there's just a lot of nuanced stuff in the way up until now we've been socialized. And I'm hoping in the future it'll be different. But I see this with women at all income levels.
Wow, that's interesting. So tell us about some of your greatest skill sets that have really helped you succeed in owning your own business.
So I have to say, if there's one thing I'm proudest of, it's my mom calling me one day. Something I tried failed. And my mom said, yeah, but you're like a weeble wobble. And so for anyone who's not of this age demographic, who knows what weeble wobbles are, they're this children's toy. And the tagline was weebles wobble, but they don't fall down. And it was like this egg shaped thing. And you could flip it all around and it would hit its head on the ground and it would bounce right back up. And, you know, now the current business buzzy term, thanks to Angela Duckworth's book, Grit, is grit. But I always think about it as I'm like a weeble wobble. And I think that has been the single biggest component. Along with that, I would say the ability to pivot and realize you try one thing and that doesn't work, and then you shift and you try another thing, and not being upset when plan A doesn't work nor B, C, or D, because ERF might work.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And if I had to add a third element, I would say curiosity. I found that once I added that to my triangle of the simplicity, small joys, and financial independence, that really turbocharged things because I would start to see opportunities that I wouldn't have even known to have asked about simply because I would be talking to someone and I would be curious about what they were doing, what their story was, exactly as you asked me, what their journey, and ideas can come from so many unique places. So I think that would be the third factor.
You know, when you shared that, I smiled when you said that because I drew out the little triangle as you were saying it because I like to make notes as we're going along, and I like to look back on the notes of things that I thought were really good or important from our interview. And so then I added the curiosity in the center and I just smiled because I think that that isn't something that people always say or recognize or think that's relevant. And yet I believe that that curiosity to learn, the curiosity to hear what others are doing, I am fascinated by what other people do and how they do it. And I have gleaned so many awesome ideas for my own business that people don't realize you can take an idea and you can tweak it out and make it fit yours, or you might change it and so it doesn't look like the same idea. But by being curious and finding out what other people do and how they're running their business or how they're earning a living or how they balance, it's like you can glean so many awesome ideas and then and actually just take one tiny little piece of it and then take off running with it and then come up with a whole new plan of action for your business or for your life. And I think that there's just a tremendous amount of people that don't put a lot of value in that being curious state of mind.
It's so true. And there were two things on that that I want to mention if this resonates with any listeners. I'm a big reader, and there's a book called A Curious Mind by Brian Glazer, who's the producer behind so many, the list is so long of how many movies he's been the producer behind that were blockbuster hits. And he started from the ground up, like literally from the ground up. And he attributes his success to what he calls curiosity conversations. And early on in his career, he made it a point to each week have a conversation, could be 15, 20 minutes, with somebody he didn't know, and be curious. And, you know, now that he's gotten more and more famous, he has curiosity conversations. He used to schedule them himself. Now his team does. And now his curiosity conversations are with people like the Dalai Lama.
Wow.
But he wrote this book talking about how that act, proactively each week, making himself have a conversation and be curious, propelled his career. And this is what really struck me. He tried to talk to people that were not in his industry. So he was getting ideas from all of these different industries. And so I've started watching this. You can buy this channel. It's for like $20 a year. It's called Curiosity Stream. And it has all these different documentaries from all these different genres. And so I try and once a week watch something off of Curiosity Stream in an area that I know nothing about, like something in philosophy or history. And you get these wild ideas for your work from places you might not ever have thought of.
Oh, I'm excited. I've made all kinds of great little nuggets. I love it that we are kind of taking our own path today, but oh my gosh, this has been really a lot of fun. So I do want to talk about a couple of your outstanding accomplishments, and then we're going to talk about the challenge, because I think that I think you've made some really great comments here, and so I want to really delve into this a little bit with our audience. So what are a couple of your really great accomplishments that you're quite proud of?
I think professionally speaking, I would say I co-authored a book with a dear girlfriend from business school in 2000. 2007, called On My Own Two Feet. And the second edition came out in 2013. And Simon & Schuster is just asking us to put out a third edition now. And it's a basic financial primer for women in their 20s and 30s. And a lot of people don't realize they call starving writers for a reason, which is that you make no money off books. The book has sold like 60,000 copies, which is great for a non-New York Times bestseller. It's kind of a tortoise type book. But the pride that we both, Sharon and I, my co-author, feel from the number of women over the years who've read the book and told us how much it's helped them, I think has been by far and away my biggest joy and source of pride. And probably the other thing, I'm really introverted, and yet I realize that if I keep my ideas in my own head, I can't make a difference. And so learning the ability to first just speak in public, and then ultimately, I've probably been on over 100 different national, they call them hits or segments. So, you know, I've literally been on everything from CNBC to the Today Show to NPR to Rachel Ray. And I remember my very first public speaking event. It was at a steakhouse. I was speaking to 10 prospective clients. I dry heaved the entire 25-minute way out there. And, this is 20-some years ago, but I kept pushing through it. And so I think the ability to see myself learn a skill that was so not in my wheelhouse, and be gentle with myself, because honestly, it took like 5-7 years, maybe 10, for me to really get comfortable with it. And so just being authentic with myself around where I'm weak and where I'm trying to develop, and then talking to people about it. So I think I've always been very open about my struggles. I'm bipolar. I talk a lot about mental health. My weight vacillates between a size 6 and a size 10, 12. I've been very open about all of these kinds of things. And I think that authenticity has been something else that, as I look back approaching age 50, I'm surprised to say that's what I'm proud of, not having made all the money that I've made or having achieved this award or that thing. It's these qualities.
Mm-hmm. Well, I also think there's lots of different books that have been written on it, but we go through seasons in life, and I think that what things become important to us. And it's really interesting, because if you've ever followed that journey, and I know John Maxwell did a section on it one time, that was one place that I had read about it, just like what we value when we're in our 20s and what we're trying to achieve, and then what we value and what we go through in our 30s, and then our 40s, and then our 50s, and then our 60s. And he kind of lays out this whole journey of sort of where we are as beings, and then what becomes really the most important things to us. And I think it's important when we're hearing that, because like, it is really important to understand the season of life that you're in. And it's also important that as you start to advance in those, I like to see that those things have changed for me, because I think it would be really sad if we didn't advance through those normal stages of life. So,
you know, I think you're bringing up a really important point, and I wish somebody had told me this earlier, because I think I struggled with moving through the stages. I heard a CEO say that the three stages are early on in your career, you believe things, or early on in your life, you feel like things happen to you. And that's, you know, when you're growing up, you don't have a lot of control. Then you get into school and you start your career, and you feel like things happen by you. And that's a really important stage. That's when you're really building your business and things are flourishing, and you are making things happen. And then depending upon, you know, it happens for different people at different ages. I was about to say lucky, and I'm like, I don't want to use that. I go back and forth in talking about success, whether using luck is a good thing or bad thing, and particularly when talking mm-hmm. with women, because the honest truth is you need a bit of luck, but then you also need chutzpah to like turn it into something. But mm-hmm. I've had the good luck to achieve financial freedom as I hit 50. And so I feel like I'm now moving maybe slightly earlier than some of my peers into the third stage the CEO mentioned, which is life happens through us, where you start giving back and connecting with others is what starts to become the bigger source of your sense of, I guess, accomplishment would be one way to say it, or joy.
Joy, yeah.
Yeah.
Yep, absolutely. But I also think that it's really important. This is what I've been doing recently, because I feel like I've kind of gone through those different seasons. I had success a little earlier on, so I'm like you. I think I kind of hit some of those milestones a little bit earlier. And so then now I'm sitting here and, you know, I'm 58 years old. And so I'm going, okay, yep, I do. I love giving back. I love helping others. It's what brings me the greatest source of joy. But then I'm sort of a little bit bored, maybe a little bit. And I'm finding myself that, so what am I? I don't want to do nothing. Do you know what I mean? Like, so then do I still have that same get up and go that I did when I was 30 and I started my business and I was on fire and I could, you know, go and I don't maybe have quite the stamina that I had at that time, but I certainly am much wiser. And so I have been going back and finding, reading tons of success stories of people that in their late 50s achieved success for the very first time. And so that's really inspiring me, because I'm like, okay, we still can take all of the great knowledge that we have and we can pour it in and still have this great success.
Well, and you know, this notion, because we live so much longer, there's a concept called Encore Careers, and there's actually a nonprofit called Encore.org. Mark Friedman runs it, and he's written a number of books about this subject, which is really, we're the first, you know, you and I are the first generation that really will have health such that, you know, for the next 20 plus, if we're lucky, 30 years, we could keep contributing. And what do we want to do in these next chapters? And are they totally different than what we did in the earlier chapters? And so I'm noticing a number of organizations and books and conversations around this. Jane Pauley, who I feel like I'm dating myself with Weeble Wobbles and Jane Pauley, but she was a famous female pioneering newscaster, and she does a lot of work with AARP and the Association for Retired Persons, and about this reinventing yourself in this next stage of life. And people are doing really interesting things, mm-hmm. like complete 180s. And I'm finding that really inspiring, because like you, I mean, it's when you've succeeded at something for so long, you can get in a rut and you can get a little bored.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And I think others outside of it don't. People tend to spur you on when you are young and you're trying something new and you're working at it, and they get excited for you. And then I find that when I'm talking about, oh, I'm excited, this is what I'm going to do, I've got this great idea and I'm going to do this next, I find that my friends go, oh, you're just tiring me out talking about it. And then they're like, oh, why do you want to do that? Surely aren't you thinking about retiring at all? And I find that there's a whole different, like, support system of how people view that too. And so you've got to surround yourself by really innovative and people that are kind of on the same page as you. And it typically is, I can tell you, not your circle of friends, which is interesting.
So Belinda, that may be your next thing, is creating a community and a business around bringing together people who think like you and I do around, I call it a retirement career, sort of this, you know, the way I've structured my life at this point is I've asked myself, if I were to retire, what would I want to do? And I've managed to craft my business and my life to incorporate those things already so that I don't have to think of one or the other. Now, you can't do that until you get to a certain stage of financial freedom and success and seniority that you can call the shots on how you want things. But when you get there, it's a delightful way to live. And one of the best, thankfully, I had a very amicable divorce. And one of the best things that I learned while I was with my ex-husband was the varying different ways in which people aged. Because he was 20 years older than me, many of his friends were 10 years older than him. And at the time, we lived in a very upscale community in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and a lot of the people there, you know, it was like their second home or their third home, and they would fly in on their private planes. And so it was a community of exceptionally successful people. And I noticed the retirees fell into two camps, those who could not let go of prior identity and those who had found the next chapter. And I don't really feel like we have many resources for finding the next chapter. So, Belinda, that may be you.
Wow. You just got me excited. I wrote that down. So that's fun, isn't it? So, okay. One of the questions that we skipped over, because I wanted to just sort of dive into a couple other things, but tell us what you're doing with your business today and how is that shaping your lifestyle today? Because I want our listeners to kind of get a clear understanding of exactly what you bring to the table for them.
Sure. So I have entered into a stage where I have run a business for the past 10 years called Money Zen that has taken various different paths, the last one of which it was a wealth management firm where I managed money for women with $3 million or more in assets. And I wanted to shift, and while doing that, I did public speaking, and I did some corporate spokesperson work, and I did consulting. And so I had multiple lines of revenue. And I wanted to shift things up a bit. And so I actually joined a wonderful firm called Brighton Jones out of Seattle because I wanted to be able to help women at any income level. And I couldn't do it under the structure that I had. So my clients came in and became clients of Brighton Jones. And the thing I loved about it is that Brighton Jones traditionally manages money for people with 1 million or more, but we are now beta testing a program where we can manage money and provide financial guidance at a truly affordable advice as a fiduciary for people who are even just starting out. And that just warms my heart. And so what I was able to do then was shift the a lot of people come to me and ask, you know, can you help me find an advisor? So I didn't want to be an advisor myself any longer, but I wanted to be in an organization where no matter what level of wealth you had, I could guide you to the right person. And then I could become, you know, some people might call it a thought leader. I think about it as being sort of an in-house professor. And I've structured things so that now through my Money Zen work, what I'm really building out is a multimedia platform where I'm focused on this concept of true wealth, where wealth is spelled W-E-L-L-T-H. And it's about helping people close the gap in two different ways. For some people, it's a closing of the gap between the way they spend their money and they spend their time and what matters most to them in life, tightening that up. And then for other people who are further down this life stage process that we've been talking about, it's closing the gap between who you think you were supposed to be and who you really are now. And so, for example, when I went to Harvard Business School, like the goal for all of us was to become the CEO of a company. Well, okay, after you've built your own thing, now who are you? And for some people, the answer is I want to be that to my last breath. but it's not for everyone. And maybe you want to become a yoga instructor. Maybe you want to become a Sherpa. I mean, who knows, you know? And so helping people find their own true wealth by moving towards what it is that they really want to be is a huge passion of mine. And so that I've been able to navigate my business and move it into an even bigger stage by joining up with this amazing firm has just been a delight. And I negotiated the right to work on a location independent basis so I can work from anywhere in the world I want. And I also have negotiated a very generous vacation schedule. So between the two, I feel like I can have all of the benefits of retiring if I want to rent a place on the beach for 2 months and work from, you know, Ibiza. I can go do that.
That's awesome. And I think that's good for people to hear that. So it isn't always just owning your own business. There's many ways that you can take those skill sets and find a place to partner with and still be able to live the life that brings you the greatest joy.
Well, because I think a lot of people don't think, like, after you build it, do you always want to maintain it on a Yep. standalone basis? And I think there reaches, some people do, but some people want to shed direct reports or P&L responsibility and really focus on the meat of the work that drew you to that business in the first place. And for me, that's what it was. I'd proved to myself I could run a business. Now I wanted to get back to the core of what I loved about the business, the content of it.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. We were just having that conversation a little bit earlier, myself and some of my colleagues. So it's interesting that it came up again today. I think it is, again, sort of the different things that we accomplish along the way and then what is bringing us the greatest amount of joy in that season that we're in. And I think it's really important to just be in tune with yourself. So what advice would you give to others wanting to kind of venture out on this path and own their own business, be entrepreneurs?
So I have five things that I always tell people as sort of like my base level core pillars. And the first is get yourself on solid financial footing first. I just see too many businesses fail in the early years because of cash flow issues, which oftentimes happen because people's personal finances were not stable enough to be able to weather the inevitable ups and downs of early cash flow streams in your business. And so, you know, while it's not possible for everyone to be debt-free before they start their own business other than a mortgage and maybe a car payment, I'd like to see people investing heavily in paying down any other sources of debt while you're mentally planning the business. The second thing I always tell people is being an entrepreneur is stressful. You can think like, oh, I want to get out of the corporate world. I want to start my own thing. I want to be in control. And it's wonderful, but it brings a different kind of stress because your business becomes like your baby and you care about it at such a deep level. It's a joyful stress, but it's a stress in a different way that many people are surprised the first go around mm-hmm. that it comes. The third thing I tell people is, at least in my experience, everything takes 2 to 3 times as long as I thought it would. And generally it costs 2 to 3 times more, because I get ideas and, you know, the idea expands. And, so to be prepared for the non-linearity of executing on an idea. And then I come back again to, while you're doing all of that, make sure I like to see people keep their personal standard of living as stable and modest as they can until the business truly is on solid footing. So you're not exacerbating entrepreneurial stress with personal finance stress. It's so natural. You get your first big contract or client and you want to buy the fancy car or this. I encourage people to wait. You get the third one and then you can go do it.
Right.
And then the other base level, and again, I'm saying my advice is coming more from a financial perspective than a personal finance perspective than a raw entrepreneurial perspective. And I'll say two last things on the entrepreneurial side, but keep your personal and your professional finances separate, because in year one or year two, that's where I see the most mistakes that come from happening when you don't do that. Mm-hmm. Once your business is flourishing, you very clearly, you often may have an entire financial team. But start off that way, even if you are the financial team on one end and the other end. And then entrepreneurially, the two things that I tell people is talk to as many other entrepreneurs as you can, both in your area of expertise and outside of your area of expertise. So you get the real story. I've never met an entrepreneur who will not be honest about the ups and downs.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last one is I really encourage people from the get-go to create their own informal advisory board of people that they can reach out to for advice and guidance. And that composition will change over time, but start with one.
Yes, absolutely. Well, that was great advice. And so in closing, Manisha, can you just tell people where they can find you and how can they connect with you?
Absolutely. So my personal home base remains moneyzen.com, moneyzen.com. And you can connect to me in all different, all my coordinates and everything are there. And if you're a podcast listener, I encourage you to go on iTunes or Google Play or Stitcher. And the podcast is True Wealth, with wealth spelled W-E-L-L-T-H. And a lot of the episodes speak directly to the things we've talked about here today.
That is fantastic. I know I'm going to check it out myself. I'm pretty excited about it. And I just want to remind all of our listeners that one of the absolute best things that you can do when you enjoy a podcast is to subscribe to it. So then you don't miss a single episode. So I'd like to encourage you to subscribe to Work From Your Happy Place and go check out Manisha's podcast and subscribe to that if you really enjoy it, which I'm fairly confident based on our conversation today that you are. And then when you have a little bit more time, always feel free to leave either one of us a review, because that's what we love as doing the podcast, is knowing that we're providing good content for you and creating something that's of value. So, Manisha, thanks so much for being my guest today. I have thoroughly enjoyed this conversation, and I know that you gave a lot of really awesome nuggets to all of our listeners.
Belinda, it was terrific being here with you today. Thank you so much for having me on.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thanks for joining us at Work From Your Happy Place. If you like what you hear, please share it with your friends and be sure to rate and review us on iTunes or Stitcher. For a free gift on finding your own happy place, please visit workfromyourhappyplace.com and click on the free audio button. Thanks again for listening.